This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Ken Massey, who, along with Alla Campanella, has co-written The Skeleton Code. Dr. Massey, welcome.
And Dr. Brewer, thank you so much for the invitation. It's an honor to be on your show.
Now, according to you, and I'm going to quote you, you said, we all have them hidden away, usually in an overcrowded and unsecure closet where they are likely to rattle loose. As prisoners, their prime directive is to slip their shackles and haunt our happiness. I'm afraid to ask what you're talking about.
I'm talking about those skeletons in our closet. We all have secrets that we hide, unless we're one of the very few who has seen the light of day and has really worked to do some spring cleaning in that closet. Most of us live our lives with various forms of skeletons in that closet, and they tend to like to slip out, whether WikiLeaks is working or not. They like to find their way out. They can come out by slip of the tongue. They can come out because you have a nosy neighbor. They can come out any number of ways. And, of course, we've written this book as a satire to treat a difficult subject because we make fun of a lot of things and tell a lot of juicy secrets, but the real intent of the book is to show that this is really not a good way to live.
Well, you know, I'm not sure about that because there are some people who would suggest that, you know, having your skeletons in a closet, that's exactly where they need to be. You just need to lock the door a little bit tighter, and who wants transparency anyway?
Right. No. And actually, that's the first 9 chapters of our book, again, written in satire, advocate just that, you know, how to, you know, you spend a lot of money on your home security system and you spend money keeping your computer and your information safe. But, you know, your skeletons are not safe. They're in this loose closet. And so you need to wise up and do a lot better job of creating a Fort Knox to hide these things. And so it's tongue in cheek. We're saying what people actually do, which is to try to keep their secrets locked away because they're afraid of the shame or the guilt or whatever it might be that they would encounter, the loss of reputation that would happen if these skeletons were exposed, or the relational disaster that might occur. And so we know that everyone keeps these secrets. We know that they're not inclined to let them free, or they would. It takes an exceptional effort and a lot of conviction and oftentimes a lot of pain before we get to that place where we're willing to deal with the dark side of ourselves. And that's kind of what we're talking about. We're not just talking about little secrets. We're talking about those things about our lives that we just don't think we can tell anyone else. And they can be feelings, or they can be thoughts, or they can be things that we've done. And they can be silly things sometimes, and they can be really significant or tragic things. But what we have discovered is that when we keep secrets or lies or anything like that dark in our closet to sort of keep them behind bars, what we're actually doing is imprisoning ourselves. And we become the actual victims of this prison system, as it were. And so we only find freedom when we are willing to set the darkest part of our life free, and to accept it and to engage it and to learn from it.
And I know there are people listening who are shaking their head and they're saying, right. I think I'll just keep,
sure they are.
I'll just keep my secrets to myself. Why is that As so I, important?
Yeah, and of course, I was the same way. I've kept secrets most of my life. And this is, you know, some of the book is autobiographical, as every book is, I suppose, but this one especially so. And so I learned from doing the things that I'm trying to encourage people not to do. And it cost me a lot keeping the secret, feels like it's saving us from something or keeping us from something, and that it would cost us to release the skeleton. And what we're saying is that's actually backwards. The real cost comes in trying to keep those skeletons hidden. And there's a lot of research now that supports this. We spend a lot of energy keeping secrets. There was a study done a few years ago, and the subject matter was a group of waiters and waitresses. And what they discovered was that these waiters and waitresses could remember an order placed by a table. You know, it doesn't matter how many people are there, they could usually remember the order until the people paid their bill, and then they could no longer recall what the order was. And it was one of the ways that they expressed this issue of short-term memory that we use. As long as something is actively working in our minds, we sort of keep it in a place where we can access it readily. It's an issue that needs to be resolved, a problem that needs to be solved, something we need to concentrate on. It's like keeping stuff on the top of your desk as opposed to putting it away in a file cabinet. But once our brains solve this issue, then it can be filed away because it's not needed so quickly in the future. But what secrets do is they're always on top of our desk. They're always cluttering our lives, and our brains keep working and working and working to solve this issue, which oftentimes can't be solved at all. But our brains work on this, so we liken it to a computer program running in the background, and your computer is running slow for some reason, and you don't know why that is. And for those that have Windows, you know, you go to the task manager, and you see that there's all this stuff running in the background, just sucking up the CPU strength of that computer. And your computer's really slowed down, and that's what our brains do when they're working on this stuff constantly, working on trying to keep it hidden, working to make sure that there's not a slip of the tongue at the party, working to make sure that they're presenting an idealized self to certain people. It's a constant drain on our lives. It's a tension and it's a drain. And so that's the first problem with keeping skeletons, is it's just a lot of work that doesn't bear any fruit at all.
Well, as you describe it, it sounds exhausting.
Yes. And I think depending on your skeleton and how many and how long you've kept it, it can be. We often think of our secrets in a sort of out of sight, out of mind way. But in fact, you know, when we forget about them, or we think we've forgotten about them, and we think they're tucked away in our closets, we're actually still working on them, and they're working on us. It's just that stuff gets pushed down often into the subconscious, and we don't realize we're doing that, but it's absolutely having those negative effects on our ability to concentrate and certainly our ability to relate to people.
Early on in the Skeleton Code, you tell the story of three clergy. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yes, because I tell that story because, you know, all of us have friends in whom we have confided and have discovered that maybe some sort of kept our secret with us, but others did not. Others could not wait to get on Twitter or to post or to get on the phone or to write a letter or whatever they did back in the day to tell this juicy bit of gossip that they've just heard. And so all of us have this hesitancy with sharing our secrets, even with good friends, because we know what a morsel they are. I mean, there's just something about a secret that begs to be told, right? And so even your best friend can come to that place where, oh, they just are dying to tell friend number three about what you just told them. And they'll say, now, don't tell anybody this, you know, but here's what happened. And of course, that's how it goes from there. And so we've all had that experience, and that's what that story's about. It's about three ministers, two of whom confide in the third, and the third who does confide in them, but it turns out that his problem is that he's an incurable gossip. So they're both in trouble.
Clearly. Now, you say that you can give visual clues that would give a Mother Teresa affect, even if you have Paris Hilton DNA. Not sure what you're saying about Paris Hilton, although it's kind of glaringly clear. But
yeah, no disrespect to Paris. I don't know her, but no disrespect to her. I had to have an example, and she seemed like one who's in the news a lot, and the people that are in tabloids, there are lots of those, and they get, you know, have various scandals that get revealed, and I guess some are true and some are not true, and I'm sure many are exaggerated. But that's sort of the nature of this process too. I think another reason we don't want to share our stuff, because we kind of see what that looks like in the political world. If when secrets come out, it can be damaging to politicians. If secrets come out in the celebrity world, it can be damaging to their reputation, although some love it. You know, I think some people maybe even stoke the fires because, you know, all I guess any attention is good attention if you're a celebrity. But some of them are hurt by it, and some of them have sued tabloids over stories that they have posted. And we see that. We see the extraordinary kind of celebrity outing, and we think, my goodness, I don't want people looking at my life that way, and I don't want people talking about me in the coffee room in the morning. I don't want them sharing my gossip everywhere, and so I'm going to put an extra lock on my closet. I'm going to clam up. I'm not going to tell a soul what I've done or what I'm thinking or what I'm capable of, because it would just destroy me if I did that. So we really do live with this fear, I think. It's survival technique to not expose ourselves to that kind of danger.
You know, what's interesting is that, you know, I think about, and you comment in the Skeleton Code about the fact that employers nowadays, they're kind of looking at everything.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, what you're saying is that it is important to free yourself of these secrets because, you know, in so many ways, they're very, very harmful. On the other hand, what we're constantly told is keep those secrets, keep it off Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and everything
right.
else, because
yes.
if it gets out there, then you will be
right.
harmed. So it's an interesting message, a pair of messages, if you will, that we're getting.
And you're right. The truth is that if it's on social media, it has a life of its own, and it's there forever, right? And so we're very careful to talk about the way we clean our closet. You know, you're not obliged, no one is obliged, nor is it healthy to tell your secrets anywhere and everywhere. You know, the intent is not to just get them out. The intent, the healthy intent, is to get them out the right way to the right people. The kind of people you can tell secrets to safely are professionals, to start with, therapists, I mean, ministers. These are the people that are bound by confidentiality. They should be non-judgmental. They should be a safe place and a safe person to tell. And so we encourage people to start there. But if your secret is actively hurting someone, then you may need to tell that person, but you're under no obligation to air your dirty laundry for the world. You know, that's not what cleaning out your skeleton is all about. Because once you have, in a healthy way, exposed your dark side, whatever it is, to even if it's just to one person, that skeleton loses its power over you. It ceases to become the haunted thing in your closet. And it just becomes an accepted part of your life that you can deal with in a healthy way. So, yeah, the idea that you should simply tell all is good, I guess, if you're wanting to write a tell-all book. And you can make some money doing that. But otherwise, don't. Otherwise, be careful and wise and responsible about the way you clean your closet out.
And, you know, even in those tell-all books and tell-all television programs, some of those skeletons are created specifically for the purpose of not telling all, but in creating, you know, a buzz, if
right.
you will.
Exactly. And this is one of the reasons we put a red bow tie on the skeleton on the front of our book, you know, because we do try to dress up our skeletons in case they are seen. we don't want them to be seen in their worst. We want them to be seen sort of at their best. And so our first choice is to not have people see them at all. But if people do get a glimpse of them, we don't want them to see the raw reality. You know, we want them to see a dressed up version. And frankly, our brains sort of do this for us. It's a similar kind of process to rationalization, which is the way that we justify thinking things or doing things. And we dress up our skeletons so that they're not so caustic to us. They don't appear that way. They don't haunt us so badly. They don't seem quite so bad. And we tell this sort of revised version of the skeleton to ourselves over and over again. And pretty soon we've come to accept it as the reality. And one of the things we encourage in the book is for people to strip down those skeletons of all of the dress up that has gone on and to really get in touch with them and their raw reality, to see them for what they really are, because they really are a part of our lives, and not to be hidden or to be run from or denied or buried, but actually to be accepted, which is a hard thing. I mean, it's a hard thing for us to accept anything that we don't like about ourselves. But if you don't accept something, it will never change. This is my view. If you don't accept something, it will never change, and it will continue to work on you. And when you do accept something, you get freedom from it.
So if you don't accept that thing or that part of you that troubles you, if you don't accept that it exists, you don't have a platform to do any work with.
Right. And we sort of have a threefold process for saying to folk, this is how you need to go about your closet cleaning. And the first step of that is to accept and embrace and face your skeletons, all of them. And the difficulty with that is that many of the skeletons we're hiding, we're not just hiding from other people, but we're hiding from ourselves as well. George Orwell famously said, if you want to keep a secret, you must also hide it from yourself. And that's what we do. We try to bury it so deeply we can't even find it. And so in the process of cleaning out the closet, what you'll find is that not only the skeletons you know about will show up, but some that you have buried so deeply you don't even remember them, some of those will show up too. And the very first healthy process in getting free from these things is to accept all of it. You know, it really is part of your life. It doesn't define your life. You know, I am not my worst thought, but I do have worst thoughts. They come from somewhere. You know, my experience or my DNA, you know, there are lots of competing ideas about where those come from, but I have them. And to hide from them is to empower them over me. When we accept them and embrace them and come face to face with them, they don't have the power over us. We tell a story in the book about a man who keeps having this nightmare about a lion chasing him. And he's very, very troubled by this nightmare. It recurs all the time. He wakes up screaming in a cold sweat. And so he goes to a therapist who's a hypnotist who helps him get back into that dream of that lion and says, instead of running from him, turn around and face him and ask him what he wants. And this man does this in a hypnotic state. He turns around and faces the lion. And when he comes out of the hypnosis, he tells the therapist, he says, the lion said, when I asked him, who are you and what do you want? The lion said, I'm your courage. Why are you running from me?
That's really so fascinating.
So the things that we run from in our lives and that we hide, oftentimes they are the things, this is the second point that we make about healing, is they have deep lessons for us to learn about ourselves. Deep lessons we would never learn going to a sporting event or being in our favorite restaurant eating our favorite dessert. They only come to us when we go down deep. Carl Jung said something like this. I don't have the exact quote, but it's basically when you stumble and fall, down there is where you find pure gold. You know, these skeletons, we embrace them and come face to face with them and accept them because they have something incredibly valuable to teach us about ourselves and about our lives that we can't know otherwise, and that we can't live in fullness otherwise. So we're all a mixed bag. You know, the whole notion of dressing up and pretending to be your idealized self is a fictional self. And I say, we've just gone past the Halloween season. Our kids dress up and pretend to be somebody else so that they can get a treat, right? But adults do this all the time. You know, we dress up and pretend to be somebody who's admirable and envy, you know, we would envy this person. Oh, they're so successful. They have it all together. We try to be this person to our public, but that's not who we are in reality. And so if anybody accepts us, this idealized version of us, if they accept that, they're accepting a fiction. And if they love us, they are loving not who we are, they're loving who we're pretending to be. And so it cuts us off from real relationship when we pretend to be somebody we're not.
Ken, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with this really fascinating conversation. Folks, don't go away. We'll be back with the Skeleton Code in just a moment. Ken Massey, co-author of The Skeleton Code, a satirical guide to secret keeping. Ken, you tell the story of Tiffany and Matt. I'd like for you to share that scenario with the audience.
Okay. Tiffany and Matt are the, and the reason you're going to have to remind me of this is because those are different names than the people I actually know.
The divorced
but these are the
couple,
right? Yeah. That one's from the South and one's from the North.
And they have a secret.
Yes, they do. Yeah, they do. And the eventual secret is that they don't really want to be married to each other anymore. And we have heard this secret my wife and I, who wrote the book together, we've heard this secret play out many, many times. It often comes out as something like a dark feeling of, I wish my spouse would die, because we can't face the reality of our marriage being sick, and we would never think to harm our spouse. And so we have these thoughts that, gosh, if they were just in an auto accident, you know, I would get all this sympathy from my friends, and I would be free from the marriage without going through the pain and the shame of divorce and that messiness and all that sort of thing. And sometimes it's people with children who have difficult children and find themselves wishing they had never had children, which is something you can never confess as a parent. But that's for Tiffany and Matt. They started off blazing, you know, guns a-blazing. Passionately in love with each other, and it didn't take long for their differences to begin to be magnified, and for them to avoid each other, and for them to despise each other, and to be really broken in their marriage. And they could not face that. I mean, that was a skeleton. Each of them had it and tried to keep it from the other in their own particular way. But again, that is a skeleton we see frequently. People can't really talk about, oftentimes, their marriage and the depth to which it's broken, and they can't talk to their spouse about it, which is the biggest issue.
And so, in that case, what would you recommend folks do?
Yeah, well, again, the first thing is to accept the reality, and to stop telling yourself a fictional story about how this is going to end, because if your marriage is going down the tubes, it's not going to recover by itself, and it's not going to get better by hiding the pain or hiding from the pain. And so you have to actually face that with your spouse. I would say the same thing about people who are dating. This is another secret we have heard frequently, is that one person in the relationship thinks that this is a long-term relationship and the other person thinks it's not long-term, but they get something out of the relationship, so they don't want to end it. They don't want to say, I don't really see our relationship going on long-term, because they like it for what it is now. But that's, again, a secret that you hide, that I have a different view of our relationship, significantly different view than you have, and I'm going to keep that from you. And no relationship can survive that, and a marriage can't survive it either. And so my counsel was to folk, and this is something that I could not do in my own marriage. I'm a product of a failed marriage too, and it was because I could not face the pain of that. I could not bring myself, because I did not want to hurt my spouse. I just did not know how to live with my spouse, and I did not know how to heal my marriage. And so I know this from personal experience. Unless you have to be willing to go through short-term pain to achieve healing. There just is no. I've forgotten now the author, but you know, the only way around something is through it. You've got to go through something. You really can't go around it. You've got to face it. And the deeper and darker it is, the more important that is. And so in a marriage relationship, you have to face it with your spouse. And I encourage people to get some help, some third-party help with that too, because often marriages that are in that bad a shape, there's not enough substance there upon which the couple by themselves can work through a solution. They need somebody to take them to a different place where they can work on their marriage in a safer place.
And I would suggest that the more energy you put into keeping the secret, actually the more the relationship tends to deteriorate.
Yeah, and it's so easy to just create new skeletons. Typically, many of our skeletons give birth to other skeletons. And so in hiding this pain in a marriage, for instance, you may engage in activities that simply create other things you have to hide. And it might not be an affair. It might be internet pornography. You know, whatever you are doing to cope or to comfort yourself in that pain, oftentimes this is another skeleton or two or ten that you also have to keep. And, you know, eventually there's too much to manage. And oftentimes we have to get to that place where it shuts us down. That's what happened to me. I mean, I was on three antidepressants because I could not cope with the reality, nor could I face it. And we try everything we can to just survive it when we could actually face it and learn from it and be free in it and find that it takes us to a better place. But it's just we have so much trouble believing that that's a possibility. Our fear gets the best of us, and we see the worst case scenario, and that's what we accept as the truth, and we just go back to our closets. It's so very sad. I mean, I see it every day.
And I would say, particularly in the case of relationships, you know, if you find that you're the first one in the family who's looking at disconnecting from your spouse, or if there's a particular religious perspective that says that you cannot or should not, that makes it that much more difficult.
It does. It does. And there are always some kind of social constraints placed upon us like that, and they could come from our religion, could come from our business, could come from just what part of the country we live in, our family system. All these things tell us this is acceptable, this is not acceptable, and oftentimes we fear what the effect is going to be if we actually try to deal with our skeletons. And we can imagine the worst. We absolutely do imagine the worst. And so we've likened it in the book to jumping out of an airplane. That was one of the most fearful things I could think about. And it is a leap of faith to do this, because you don't ever know exactly what the response is going to be. But what I would say to folk is you can know what the long-term effect will be when you jump. When you jump well, when you deal with your secret the right way, there's going to be some pushback. You may suffer some short-term pain because of it, but you free yourself from a much deeper long-term dysfunction and pain when you set those secrets free.
You know, I think about children who have all manner of secrets. Some of them may be the result of a trauma. Some of them may be the result of a playground misunderstanding. But I wonder if you would guide those listening who have children to talk to their children about skeletons in the closet.
Yeah, and of course, part of that is children have to learn that it's safe for them to be themselves and to say these things to their parents, for instance. And if parents tend to be highly punitive or shame-inducing, if there's been a lot of finger-wagging, that's a bad feeling for a child, and especially for a child. I mean, even adults don't deal with that well, but a child especially, it can really injure their spirit. But a child that grows up in an environment that shames them is going to be less and less likely to do that which leads to shame. So they're going to bottle up. They may not tell anyone, but they're certainly not going to tell the people that can actually help them with the secrets. And so, yeah, family secrets are some of the most toxic of all, and they happen sometimes with kids. Sometimes parents keep secrets from their children they should not keep from their children. That's a balancing act to know what to tell children and what not to tell children. Sometimes siblings keep secrets from siblings. I know we know a family whose wife committed suicide. The husband could not keep it from the oldest sibling. So the husband and the oldest sibling knew about it, but they kept it from the three other children in the family, the three siblings. And it became a huge wedge in their family system.
I would think so.
The father and the oldest daughter keeping that secret from the other three. And it was a wedge, and of course the three children didn't know. They thought it was just the pain of the death that was attributed to another cause. And eventually the father came clean with that, and of course the three siblings were incredibly upset that this had been kept from them. And the father thought he was keeping it from them to protect them, but he couldn't deal with the pain himself. That was the truth of it. And the truth was that they could and would deal with their mom's suicide, but they couldn't if it was a secret. Okay? And so the family is on a road to healing, but they went through a lot of pain to get there.
And it sounds like, in fact, the father was keeping the secret to protect himself. It was, as you said,
of course,
it was just too much for him.
That's right. And this is why we ultimately keep secrets. We sometimes fool ourselves into thinking, well, if I tell this, I'm going to hurt somebody else. But probably it's because we think we're going to hurt ourselves. Now, again, I want to give the caveat that when you're ready to reveal a secret, which is the third step for us, you know, you accept it is number one, you learn from it, number two, and three, ultimately, you have to tell it to someone. You have to tell it to the right person, and you have to not tell it to the wrong person. I think Alcoholics Anonymous or any 12-step system, they have some good wisdom about this. They talk about doing an inventory of your life and being radically honest about what is going on in your life, but to consider, before you share something with someone, to consider what it actually does to them, and are they able to bear that revelation? Because it's not just about me purging something that's toxic inside of me on whoever I want to purge it on. It really is about doing something that's healthy. And there are some people who can't bear our secrets. But there is always at least one person who can. And that's the person we need to tell it to. And then from there, when we get sort of freed from the toxic nature of it, we can make better decisions about who else I might need to tell this thing to. And it may be nobody else. But it may be somebody else, and it takes some wisdom to decide who to tell and who not to tell.
Well, certainly I agree with that completely, because on the one hand, you know, you can, if you're telling yourself that keeping the secret protects someone else, mm-hmm. but in fact it's protecting you. But there may be times when you really are protecting that other person, and so you really
right.
do have to be able to discern the true basis of your need to keep that secret, that skeleton in your closet. Is it for you? Is it for them? And what's the fallout? And that's hard work.
It is. And no one is under any obligation to tell everyone everything. And for us, the tipping point is, if I tell this secret, is it going to create freedom and love in this relationship? Does it have the chance to heal as opposed to hurt? I mean, it's going to be painful. Pain's not the question, but we don't want to be hurtful. That is, we don't want to cause injury, even though we've caused pain. So tell the secret if there's a good chance that telling it will allow healing in the other person and some freedom in the other person as well as you. And sometimes it takes us being honest about that secret with somebody else first and to get to a better place with it. And then we're able to better discern whether we should share it with someone else or not.
You know, I think too about the folks who, under the guise of being brutally honest, will say
yeah.
all kinds of horrifying, hurtful things. And so clearly what you're saying is be prudent, be mindful, be thoughtful.
Yes, of course. Of course, yeah. It's not just about dumping your toxic waste on somebody else. You know, in the first place, I think you ought to work internally to help that become less toxic for yourself. And when it's less toxic for you, it's going to be less toxic for other people. If you can have a honest relationship with someone without telling them your secret, without dumping that and putting that obligation on them, then by all means have the healthy relationship as it is. But if the secret becomes a wedge between you, that's when I think you have to seriously think about, you know, this is hurting our relationship. I've got to talk to them about this.
And, you know, the other thing I think about secrets is that they really can take on the tentacles almost of an octopus, because they get so
yeah.
complicated, so involved. And
yes. Yes. And there is no easy path. This is one of the reasons we use satire in the book, and we tried to use some humor liberally, because it really is a heavy conversation. It's a heavy topic. You know, if we wanted to deal with our secrets, we would, but the fact is we don't really want to deal with them. We want to hide them. And so we've written the book as a satire so that people will read it and laugh at other people's secrets, but in the process come face to face with their own. You know, in a way that's not preachy. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Because we all have defenses. We don't want our secrets exposed. So we've had fun with other people's secrets, and we hope that other people will have fun reading the book. But ultimately, it will become a mirror for them, and they will see what they're doing in their own lives and think, you know, this really is crazy, how I'm living, and I don't have to live this way. I could actually do something different with my life that would make a lot more sense and be a lot more healthy.
And I
think we've got to talk about social media
yes.
at some point here, because if there's an easy place to create skeletons by the hundreds, it's on social media. And I think about people who are putting up profiles on dating sites, for instance, how inclined they are to fudge about themselves in order to make themselves more attractive to somebody. A little like padding your resume to make yourself more attractive to an employer.
Right.
But social media and the anonymity that it brings create all kinds of possibilities for us to do this duplicitous thing that we do, which is have a public persona that is really not who we are.
Bears no
or it's an idealized yeah. version of who we are.
Sometimes bears no resemblance at all.
Sometimes, yeah.
Kimber-
and okay, so if somebody contacts you on the matchmaking site and they are really attracted to the person you've put down on paper, well, they're not interested in you.
Exactly.
They're interested in this person that you've created. So it's a lose-lose, but we do it anyway.
Ken, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with social media. Don't go away, folks. What would you say is perhaps one of the greatest dangers, if you will, from your perspective, in dealing with the world of social media, which is all around us 24/7?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say the anonymity and the pseudo-anonymity of social media. First, the pseudo-anonymity. There's a sense that in which we think when we're communicating through a computer that somehow we can hide behind that. I've done some research in chat rooms just to see what kind of language is used when people are talking about a sensitive topic, and it will peel the paint what people say to each other because there is this feeling of anonymity. You don't really know who I am. You know my little tag name that I have here, and I can say anything I want to you. And some of the, violent language, not just inappropriate, but violent language, sometimes used in these chat rooms. And it's because we're hidden, partially hidden in a way. But the other flip side of that is that sometimes we can put things out and we think that nobody's going to see them 10 years from now, but they become permanent when they become part of cyberspace. And people have posted things that later kept them from getting jobs that they really wanted or that embarrassed them with their family. And so sometimes there's this feeling that I can post this and get away with it, and only the people that like it are going to see it. But it ends up getting into somebody else's hands and causing pushback. So it's this thing about an anonymity and quasi-anonymity that encourages us to maybe live out the worst side of ourselves in public ways. These are things typically that if we're face-to-face, we have social constraints and we don't say these things. But sometimes on the internet, we're willing to say things we would never say otherwise. And it's usually our worst self that comes out when people are angry and emotionally caught up in a conversation. And I don't know that that's healthy. Some people think that venting is healthy, and maybe some forms of it are, but I'm not convinced that the kind of venting we see on social media actually helps people offload their emotions. I think it's possible that it actually magnifies those feelings. And they go away not resolved, but more and more feeling like that's the feeling that they own and that owns them and defines them. And so I don't believe in the boogeyman, but there's something about this that I think is hurtful to human relationships.
With self as well as others, you know, the healthiest
yes.
form of venting, if you will, is perhaps in writing it down for yourself.
Sure.
And not leaving it around for somebody else to accidentally read.
But right.
But perhaps destroying it, but at least getting it outside of your body.
Yeah, and we do have to find ways to do that, but I'm just not sure that the way we're doing social media is maybe the best way. And again, that's why I advocate speaking with a professional if you have issues like that. But oftentimes, I think social media taps into our deepest, darkest emotions, and sometimes we get carried away in that venue and say and do things that we would never do. If it were face-to-face in a room full of people, we would just never do that. And so for all the benefits of social media, and there are many benefits, I don't mean to just say it's all bad, but this is a liability, I think, for social media. And for those who are trying to live a transparent life, I don't think that's transparency. I think that's just an unhealthy way of dealing with the stuff that you need to deal with a different way.
And clearly what we know about the negative aspects of social media, in addition to the anonymity, is that, I mean, you can actually generate a frenzy around a person or a place or a thing, and it can easily spin out of control.
Yeah, it does take a life of its own. And gosh, we saw that in the Arab Spring, didn't we? It was a lot of that was driven by social media, so it can actually cause a movement or a revolution. So it can certainly cause problems in relationships, right? And in our jobs and in our families and so forth. So it feels to me a little like the way you'd want to handle nitroglycerin. You know, just be very, very careful with it and realize its limitations. I hope social media doesn't ever take the place of social interaction in our culture. There's something about physical touch and sight that is important to relationships that you can't get even over a screen if you're doing FaceTime, that I hope we can hang on to as a culture. But especially when it comes to hiding things about yourself or in pretending to be someone that you're really not, social media is a great way to do that, because you can really make people envious. You know, this is what I see a lot, is people will post pictures of their vacation, their exotic vacation. And I hear from people all the time who say, I see my friends, they've gone to Paris, and I can't help but be envious. I know I should be happy for them, but it makes me envious that I can't afford to go to Paris. Or they'll see them with their new car, or they're at the ball game, and, you know, I couldn't afford to do that, and I feel envious instead of happy for them. And I know that's their issue, but there's something about social media that encourages us to present the very best part of our lives, and people kind of look at that and say, gosh, they have such a great life. But we don't post all the negative stuff that we experience.
And sometimes that trip to Paris is actually a Photoshopped postcard.
Yeah, right. Yes, it could be. It could be. And you can get those for a lot less than you can get an airline ticket, I understand.
Indeed. Now, we've been spending a lot of time talking about the sort of the curse of having skeletons in your closet. Is there a cure?
There is a cure. Before we get to the cure, I want to say one more thing about the curse. There is a lot of research now out about the physical toll that secrets take on us. It's not just a mental drain. There are people who have discovered that people suffer from headaches, from nausea, their immune system is compromised. Of course, anxiety and feeling blue. These are negative physical symptoms that go along with repressing secrets. And this is where the book is autobiographical for me, because I experienced that as well. I was keeping a significant secret. I had severe sciatica down my right leg, tingling and numbness in my leg. I went to two neurosurgeons who did an MRI, and in my lower back I had a compressed disc and some bone spur material there that they thought was causing that, and so they recommended surgery on my lower back. But my secret came out, and my sciatica went away. And now people kind of look at me sideways when I say that, thinking I'm exaggerating, but it did. It was severe. I mean, it disrupted my daily life. I couldn't get comfortable sitting. I couldn't get comfortable lying down. It interrupted my sleep. It was awful. And when my secret went out, it didn't go away permanently just like that. It went away just like that, and it came back, and then it went away again. And the more I processed my secret, the more I took took care of it, accepted it, embraced it, learned from it, the less sciatica I had, and now I have none, zero. And this has been 3 years ago now. So people can actually have physical symptoms from keeping secrets. And of course, you can. There are other reasons you might have back pain or sciatica. I understand that. But if you have some sort of chronic pain, fibromyalgia, Dr. John Sarno, who used to teach at New York University in the medical school there, he's retired now, but he's done extensive research on this. And he says that it's related to tension, to stress, basically, the stress of keeping repressed feelings and repressed secrets. And thousands of people have been relieved of their physical symptoms, not from surgeries or medicines, but from actually getting rid of their secrets, getting rid of their skeletons. So I would encourage people, if you have chronic pain, you can look up John Sarno, S-A-R-N-O, some of his books. I would encourage you to read those. And now we can shift to the skeleton cure.
Well, before we do that, let me okay. ask you, I mean, clearly, literally, your secret was a pain in your back. Literally.
A pain, yes. Uh-huh.
Does it matter how the secret comes out? Does it matter if you take charge of the secret and disclose it yourself, or if somebody else sort of pulls it out from under you and there you are?
Mine was my brother pulled it out of me because I was unwilling to face it. So I would say more often than not, it will be because the skeleton has come out without you intending it to come out. And that's the good news. I mean, it may cause you some pain short term, but in this case, it was a huge relief from my pain. My brother helped me do that. And once I started facing it and digging into it, that my sciatica got progressively better and better and better. Now it's completely gone. So, but I don't think it matters. What matters is that the skeleton, if you're hiding it from yourself, comes into your conscious mind. It doesn't stay repressed, stays in your consciousness, and ultimately that you're able to talk to somebody about it and really get it out on top of the table and deal with it for what it is and be honest about it. And for those of you that have chronic back or neck or shoulder pain, especially those kinds of things, I encourage you to read Dr. Sarno's book. It's called Healing Back Pain is the name of it. But I don't think we really know the extent to which our minds can cause physical symptoms in our bodies. I know we sort of give a nod to that, and we think there's a mind-body connection, but I think it's probably deeper than we know.
I agree with you. I also would say that I think we're becoming more aware of it than we have been in years past.
And I hope so. I hope we'll continue to do that.
All right, let's talk about a cure.
Yeah. Well, we've already sort of dealt with that a little bit. The cure begins with accepting what we cannot change, accepting that part of us that we wish was different, accepting that part of us that we have guilt feelings about, or that maybe people have shamed us about, to accept it and to embrace it and to recognize, you know, it doesn't define us, but it is part of who we are. There's a reason we did that. There's a reason we thought that. There's a reason we felt that. And we don't need to blame ourselves for that. It just is. It just is. Even if we wouldn't choose it, it's still part of who we are. And so we get that out into the open and we face it. And what we discover is that there's something important in that skeleton that we need to learn. And again, this is part of the cure, is to discover it's not our enemy. It's not the roaring lion chasing us to devour us. It is wanting to tell us something about ourselves, about our life, and I think about our path to healing, because the way I found it, I think a path to healing and this cure was because I suffered from keeping skeletons in my closet. And so they were actually my teachers, my very best teachers. And so part of the cure is learning from those skeletons, and then part of the cure is taking the leap and telling the right person about it and having conversation with them about it. Because ultimately, I think in most spiritual traditions, there is some admonition to confess things that you've done that are hurtful to God or to a priest or to somebody. There is something really, really important about verbalizing what has been hidden in our lives, letting it come out through our mouth, and having another person hear it and not judge us for it. and not condemn us for it and not shame us for it, but rather to accept it, accept us and accept that thing that we've told them, and to see that life actually doesn't get worse when we do that. But now suddenly I'm feeling this lightness in my soul. I'm feeling this, I don't feel like I weigh as much. This burden I was carrying on my back doesn't weigh quite as much as it did before. And the more I talk about this and resolve it and come to accept it, the less of a burden it becomes, until finally I'm just completely free of it, completely free of it. I don't feel like I have to hide it from anyone, and I don't feel like I have to tell anyone. You know, it just is what it is. And so to accept our secrets, to learn from them, and then to find someone who can actually look us in the eye and say, I still love you. You know, you're still a good person. I hear what you did. You know, I've got some secrets too. You want to hear those? because I promise you, everybody you tell a secret to has secrets of their own.
Indeed.
That they're hiding too. So this is part of the healing process. But I would say the biggest step for me was discovering that the identity I thought was my main identity, that is, who my ego, who I thought I was, who I had tried to become as a person, you know, going to school and having a certain kind of job and doing things, the right things and good things, and I was trying to build a life for myself. And everybody does that, and that's actually important and essential. But that's not, I don't think, who I actually am. That's who I've tried to create myself to be. Who I actually am, I think, is someone created by a higher power. And I think that identity is my primary identity, and it is a gift. It's not something that I earn. And therefore, it's not at risk when I stumble and fall. And when I do something I think I should not have done or that's hurtful to somebody else, I don't suddenly become a bad person. You know, I'm the person that God created me to be, and I never stop being that even when I act badly. And so all I need to do is deal honestly and openly with the times that I fail, and accept that as part of the way I do life, but it's not my identity. It's not who I am. Who I am is a sacred being.
Ken, is there a website that folks can go to learn more about the Skeleton Code?
Yeah, it's the title of the book. So it's theskeletoncode.com, and that's our website. And of course, they can find the book on Amazon or Books A Million, Barnes & Noble, all the major online booksellers. And it should be in bookstores pretty soon.
Wonderful. Ken Massey, thank you so much for joining us today and discussing The Skeleton Code, a satirical guide to secret keeping.
And thank you, Dr. Brewer, for having me.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.